make is that the civil rights agenda must include the preservation and enhancement of HBCUs. While it's a good thing, and NAPIO and all of the associations represented here have fought collectively to make sure that our students have a broad and diverse range of options for higher education, the fact is that historically and predominantly black colleges today are continuing to do a better job of graduating and enrolling into graduate and professional school African-American students than any other institutions, except there are very few numbers of the Ivy Leagues. So for the overwhelming majority of African-American students, regardless of what school they go to, their outcomes are greater if they come to a historically predominantly black college and university. There are 5,500 colleges and universities nationwide. African-American institutions represent 6% of those higher ed institutions. They're enrolling about 16% of African-American students going into college and university today. But the significant fact is that they are graduating in excess of 40% of African-American students coming out of college and university, particularly in growth areas such as science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So our performance, retention, and graduation rates are disproportionately better than any other university. Our costs are lower. In a warm and nurturing environment, HBCUs are taking students, many of whom could compete at any institution, but some would not be in an institution but for HBCUs. They're transforming their lives, they're creating opportunities, and assisting these students to get not only an undergraduate degree, but into the most competitive graduate and professional institutions nationwide. So the civil rights agenda, building on the door that Reverend Jackson opened in 1971 when he started Operation Push. Operation Push took the civil rights movement in a broader direction, whereas we're not focusing just on civil and constitutional rights, but Push was founded as a silver rights, an economic justice, entrepreneurship, educational opportunity. We have to stay in that direction. We have to make sure that our students have the grounding that they need, that our youth are reclaimed, especially our African-American boys and young men who we're losing disproportionate numbers, and that our HBCUs that are the center and the focal point of our communities along with our faith institutions are strong so that we can continue to produce those who will thrive as leaders, not only in the workforce and in the economy, but in political positions and other positions of power and service nationwide.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Dr. Miller, for the other famous panelists. 1865, for the first time in 246 years of slavery, we gained citizenship rights. It did not come with the Emancipation Proclamation. That was the proclamation without emancipation. Be able to step in the right direction. The 13th Amendment that ended slavery, and it won a pass by 2 votes. It shows how schizophrenic we've always on the question of freedom of African American people. And out of that battle in which our work and sacrifice saved the Union from treason and saved the Union from France and Britain allying with the South to split the country. We were promised the full citizenship rights, leave the right to vote in 1870. It was a promise that was vacated, a promise that was unfulfilled. The reason I give this kind of bit of historical context, I think too often, we look at 2020, we have to look at this 400-year period in its totality, Dr. Leonard. That is to say that when we operate out of context, we do not see just how deep and profound are our challenges. 246 years of legal slavery built upon a theological premise that God had ordained it, that we were the cursed descendants of Ham, And based upon that curse, that the premise has had the right to treat us that way. And out of our theology, our view of people, comes our politics, our laws, our economics, our culture. When Lincoln spoke of Emancipation Proclamation, he was attacked by the right-wing church, because he had violated and intervened in regards to divine order. He had to die, and he was killed. The 5,000 soul lynchings were not mostly abductions by night, as in the case of Emmett Till. Most lynchings were faith-based lynchings that took place after church on a Sunday. They were rituals. They were not abductions by night. They were not men wearing hoods. They had little hoods on. It was a source of celebration. Men in their shirts and ties, and women in their bonnets and hats. Down that lynch, keep on down the road, Dr. King's letter, Birmingham Jail, was written to whom? It was written to the white right-wing church. Many of them have not invaded our theology and therefore begin to twist people's minds. And so here's the challenge of our church to have a liberation theology. It doesn't serve us well to have a picture of Dr. King in the vestibule of dignity, and a picture of Malcolm X in the study to look tough, and Pat Roberts' theology from the pulpit going backwards. There is some sense in which there is today and has always been a struggle for whose God is God. That is the God of bless my slaves, keep them humble, and thank you for providing me with them. And there's a God that does not believe in them, the God of liberation. There is this struggle between the gods. And I think that, I'm putting this out there because there is, in a sense, this kind of invasion of our thought process. And here we are today, 2005, as we project what we think might happen in 2020. Their plans to have Judge Roberts as the Chief Justice in 2020. This is the judge who told Reagan how to undermine funding for the King Center, not to cut Mrs. King. This is the judge who, in the Bolden case in Mobile, sought to undermine it and said Boomerang's action must be extended. This is the judge who's against women's right of self-determination, against workers' right to organize. He's being packaged as velvet over a strong right-wing fist that at least as dangerous as Bullock ever was. So we should not be confused by, as we go forward, by wolves in sheep clothing, because there was a time when the wolves just all howled as wolves. Bull Connor howled as a wolf. Jim Clark howled as a wolf. But in late years, they've been able to put black faces over their wolf philosophy. They've been able to soften it with the tone of charm offensive, putting women over its face. The opposition has become much more adept at wolf in sheep clothing politics, which has a way of neutralizing our action. Secondly, Voting Rights Act, this coming August the 6th, we have a major march in Atlanta, Georgia, 40 years after the Voting Rights Act. Why must we march? Congressional Black Caucus commitment to vote for the first time in 5 years. Congressman Jackson said President Bush would support extending the Voting Rights Act with enforcement powers. President Bush said, I don't support the DC statehood. He's not going to ask you. Carl pushed the wrong button. You support a voter rights extension with enforcement powers. Bush said, I don't know what you're talking about. He gets to my desk and I look at it. But that's incredible in that Texas is one of the states under the Voting Act. He knew better. What happened the next week was, in Georgia, they reduced voting rights options ID from 18 to 5. You can only use state-issued ID. How does that interpret? You go to Georgia Tech and use your ID to register. You go to Morehouse System, you can't use your ID to register, they are private schools. 100 counties in Georgia have no voter ID issuance point. If you don't have transportation, you can't get there. Or if you do drive, the gas amounts to a poll tax. But they say it's about fraud. You can vote online or absentee without any ID at all. How does that smell? So if Ashcroft will not enforce the Voting Rights Act on Tom DeLay's maneuver, we got one black congressman out of the deal, but less likely to kill a chairman with six more white Republicans. Y'all get that? So we got somebody to come to this deal. You got one black congressman, but I submit to you, one black congressman, not a trade-off, but six more white Republicans, which stops Florida from becoming chairman. And so we march on that day. And I want to thank all those who are going to march and those who get it. And this much in closing, there will be a second round, is that beware of this international drug insurgency of our community. There's not a black non-dealer in America. We don't grow cocaine a single ghetto. It's just grown in Guatemala. We don't grow a single weed or poppy in Afghanistan. And yet, we are the ones that are now in every southern state. The number one industry is the arrest process of millions of blacks in jail. That's what's driving the data that Les is talking about. Because if the purchases are coming from the outside, purchasing insurgents, and if the guns are coming from the outside, gun insurgents, as in Syria and Iraq, if the cocaine and crack is coming out, and heroin, then we are the mule. They may be the fools in the process. So I really want to thank you, Joe, for the discussion and really for the relief, but I submit to you that as we put the Voting Rights Act is in jeopardy, and the drug insurgency is driving the agenda downward. Thank you.
As we come today, I think we all realize that we have a great job to do in helping our present generation understand something of what the struggle has been. It is not easy. I remember just a few years ago being in Chicago at the home of Mrs. Wyatt, and we had a wonderful meeting with a group of women, most of whom were in high places in corporations. And at the end of the evening, one of them leaving the door said to me, and it was a snowy night, so they had to want to be there. At the end of the evening, she greeted me and she said, "Mrs. Bethune, I'm so happy to meet you." And Mrs. Wyatt and I, we all laughed. Then we said, "This means that we are not telling our history."
Yes.
My social work training kept me from saying to her, "Mrs. Bethune died in 1955. But I think it says that we have to really tell our story. The segregation laws are gone. The doors are open. And so many have gone through the doors without knowing how they got open.
That's right.
And some don't care how they got open.
Yeah.
Whatever the condition, we have to work hard to get to tell our history. It has to be known that the civil rights movement changed the structure of this country.
Yes.
When it moved out of place, the spirit of Jesse Rutherford Ferguson and broke down, made laws of segregation illegal. That was something that I think has to be understood. It opened the way. And if we're not all the way that we need to go, but made it open. That we have now new laws that we're lacking reinforcement. And as Reverend Jackson has said, we have to really look at the voting rights that had been promised in the Constitution. But the Voting Rights Act is now having to be reinforced. We need our action. That gives us an opportunity for younger people to learn more about the Voting Rights Act, how it came about. We should never forget about a Sunday at Selma that resulted in the Voting Rights Act. And and some of you who were here were there. We also have a job to do, to deal with the issues related to women. I think that we, as we have worked on our civil rights, it has often been true that we are so involved in the racial factor that we forget what Mary Church Terrell said, that the woman of color is victim of both racial and sexual discrimination. She has a double task. And even some women have to be alerted to the women's rights. If you look at the statistics, you will find that families headed by women, the majority of those families are in poverty, not because the women are not working, because many are working, but they do not have, but they work for women's wages. And that is why women have a double task. And I'm pleased to say that I think we are making some progress in that era. You remember at the March on Washington, we didn't hear a woman's voice except the one who sang the national anthem. But I don't think you have seen any meeting since then where that was the case. Because we had a meeting of women afterwards who said, after the March, we have recognized the role of women in the quest for equality. And we've been there, we've backbone every institution. And I often say that African American women are women who don't do just what they want to do, but always do what they have to do. And we're always in there doing it, but I think we also have to say it's been helpful as we see the issues of race and sex as two areas in which we all have to work together. I think our task is more complicated because it was easier to strike down the separate drinking fountains than to deal with issues around the courts. But it does mean that we have to study hard, that we have to do more to work in our study. And as the description of the population is concerned, and we are shown that there will be more minorities collectively, will be more